Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we have a very interesting guest this evening. Her name is Cheryl Costa, and she has a new book out on UFO sightings. Hi, Cheryl. How are you this evening?
Very good, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Why don't you start out, tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
I'm just recently retired. I served in the Air Force and the Navy. I was in aerospace for 32 years. And I've been always had kind of a sideline around the media, talk radio, and that type of thing. And about 2013, I started a newspaper column with Syracuse New Times. It was a weekly column. It's still going. It's called New York Skies. And I was basically just writing what New York people are reporting for UFOs on a weekly basis and telling a good story to go with it. And then that's pretty much it. And then about 16 months ago, I was always doing New York State statistics, and we came up with a really good process for crunching the numbers. So my spouse and I decided, well, heck, let's try and do this for the whole country. And that was about 16 months ago, and it's chewed up every weekend for the last 16 months.
What did you do in aerospace?
The first 4 or 5 years I was producing industrial films for an aerospace division, and then I went off to work in a submarine support, technical support organization for about 5 years. And then about 1990, I moved into IT, information technology, and I was a desktop support technician and consultant for a couple of years. And then computer viruses started being an issue, and I wasn't scared to work on them because I was an old microcode programmer to begin with, so I got into computer security at that point, and I spent the last, probably the last 15 years of my career in corporate IT security.
I'm a software engineer. I have been for the past 25 years, and today I was fortunate enough to work from home and just quit coding in time to start the show.
That's the way it goes,
you know. That's the way things work in this field, you know. I know you probably understand that. So you've done a lot of different things besides just writing books, right?
Well, my writing has been principally writing the column. As a writer, okay, I'm a playwright by trade. I've got about 30 published plays, published and produced plays out there. For about the last 10 years, I've been on and off writing a few short mysteries, you know, to be included in compilations, that type of thing. Now that I'm retired and I've got my day to myself, I've been really diving into my writing again. I'm writing some of my mystery protagonists and a bunch of different things. The UFO book has been the biggest project I've ever worked on. It took me a good clear 9 to 10 months to crunch the data and get it into a format that we can make charts and tables and graphs and things. And then it took us the last, the last 4 months to do the layout for a book. It was difficult because this is a book that is 8.5 by 11, 370 pages or 380 pages, something like that, and it looks like something the Census Department put out. you know, because it's got maybe five chapters of verbiage in the front where I do a little bit of analysis and things like this, but the majority of it is we rank the national stats, we rank the individual state stats, and then we can take it literally right down to the county for any particular state over the 15-year period of 2001 to 2015.
You know, I wanted to ask you, so many things I want to ask you. How did you go from plays to UFOs?
Okay. Remember, the play was always a vocation. Okay, I've been in theater since I was 15. And then I studied playwriting in college, parallel to my filmmaking. And actually, I got dragged into the program because the playwriting professor saw a movie, an independent film I made in college, and dragged me into his playwright program. And it was probably the best thing I ever did because it really gave me some focus. And then, like I said, I produced probably about 70 industrial films back in the middle 80s. The UFO side of this thing came. I was always a UFO bystander. I saw my first one when I was like 12 years old, okay, and it's about 1965. I saw my second verifiable UFO sighting Christmas Eve 1971. I was in Cameron Bay, Vietnam. I worked for a communications squadron at the time, and I was walking to the base chapel to go to midnight mass, and I looked up, and I saw this bright streak going across the western sky, and I thought, oh, probably just a jet, you know. And then all of a sudden, it stopped, and I sat there and looked at it, and I said, "Are you a UFO?" in my head, and the thing started darting around like a little pixie up there, and then it took off at like warp speed, and I'll never forget it. It was amazing. That was like probably my first one was like when I was 12. We saw a great big large sphere in the sky, parked out there for like 20 minutes, and when it finally decided to leave, it also left at incredible speed.
You know, this is such a huge field. I don't think people realize what they're getting into. I certainly didn't when I started
yes.
studying this. It interconnects with every single topic that you can think of, and it's just this gigantic iceberg, and you're looking at it from the top, and then you go down and there's more and more. I'll give you an example. There's a contactee in Switzerland that's taken over 1,000 photos, made 30 films of ships, and he's 80 years old now. He's been having these contacts since he was five. Billy, of course, and he's written over 40 books. You know, 40 books. I mean, that's my focus now. Because I went.
Can I give you a perspective on Billy?
Sure.
I've had a lot of people. Okay, let me. A little short story goes with this. In late 89, 90 time frame, 1990 time frame. I was sort of between apartments at the time, as I had just broken up with a spouse. And I had been just different people letting me have, I'm going to say, their guest room for a period of time. We were looking for a good place to settle, okay? And this is in the D.C. area. And I had to have real serious abdominal surgery all of a sudden. And when I was getting ready to recuperate, a friend of mine said, he worked in the government, and he said, "Hey, look, I'm taking care of my dad who's got cancer. I got a cat over there in Laurel, Maryland. Here, let me give you I'll meet you over there." He gave me the address. He met me at the house. He says, "Here, stay here for the next 3 months while you're recuperating."
Wow.
I said, "Okay." He says, just feed the cat. So I said, "Fine." So I did that. Well, this guy had, you're going to love this, first editions on just about every major book on UFOs that had been printed up until that time.
Wow.
First edition hardbacks on just about everything that was out there. There was a hardback edition of Von Daniken's book. He had everything written by Stanton Friedman. Well, the house, he didn't have cable in this house because he was, again, living with his father who had cancer. So I had this private library to read. And I read everybody thing I could in there. And I got the, excuse the expression, the proverbial college education in about 6 months doing this.
My goodness.
But again, I was never really deeply involved beyond that. Now, what happened? 2012, I'm working for a newspaper. I'm retired from the aerospace industry. I got a full-time job. I was kind of like a production technician at night at a daily paper, okay? And all I had to do was produce 1,000 printing plates every night, and as soon as the presses got running, all I had to do was sit there and wait in case they needed a replacement plate. And I also supported some of the electronics, okay? And this is 2012. I was reading CNN.com, and there was this sidebar story that said, UFOs have been on the decline since the 1980s. Maybe they were all just an urban legend anyway. And in the back of my head, I'm sitting here saying, that doesn't feel right. That feels like misinformation.
Exactly.
So I, for first time in my life, I went out like to MUFON.com. And I did some pulling off their database. And I sat there with a spreadsheet open at my desk and then dropping numbers in over a period of, you know, like a couple of years. And I had this chart that went from this small number almost exponentially up as it got closer to, you know, to about 2000. And I'm going, I came home and looked at my spouse and said, what memo didn't the UFOs get? You know? Because this thing went up like a rocket. And that's when I got really interested from the standpoint of this, what's the word I want to use, the misinformation. I said, somebody's got to start telling the truth about this stuff. And I knew I was well-read enough to talk about it. So I went to a dozen editors in upstate New York and said, I'd like to write a weekly column for you or something like this. Maybe do it on the science edition every week or something. And I got laughed out of more offices than you can shake a stick at. In fact,
really?
One of the first editors I talked to, and I had a good pitch. I really had a good pitch. I had numbers. I had 5 slides with numbers and statistics and demographics. I did my homework. And I walked in with 5 printed slides. Never walk in with a thumb drive. You know, they'll walk out before you plug in the thumb drive and boot up the machine. So I'm old school. I went in there with 5 slides and document protectors. That was it. And this one editor looked at me, and she said, she was a night editor of paper, and she said, and what brand of tinfoil do you wear on your head?
Wow.
And I asked her, and I said, I asked her, I said, do you guys get calls every week here at the news desk? She said, yeah, we get about 6-7 of them a week. And I said,
6-7
do you
a week?
Them? Said, yeah, and they were hanging up on them, calling them all nuts.
Oh, really?
And I'm like, now you do the math on that. What is that? 7, we'll we consider 7 times 52 weeks. There's 364 right there that didn't show up on somebody's database.
And think about how many people also saw things that didn't call in, right?
Well, we call it the Friedman factor. It's like 1 in 10 reports them.
Wow,
so,
yeah.
So the deal is, and there's some basis for that. So what the bottom line was, I finally did find an editor. He had left the newspaper I was actually working for and went to a weekly. And I made a phone call over to him to ask him if I could come over and pitch him something and sat down, and we talked about what the topic matter. He wouldn't even look at my slides first. I thought, well, this is going to go nowhere. He just wanted to talk. And this guy apparently read all the same books I did because he started asking me questions, like he was quoting Frank Edwards and all these kinds of things, Von Daniken and things, you know. And
wow.
One of the questions he asked me, he says, who asked 256 questions? And I looked at him and I said, Eric Von Daniken did. And he got criticized for making statements when he asked questions.
Mm.
You know, and so him and I resonated. In 20 minutes, we resonated.
Sure.
So he says, okay, I'm going to go ahead and let you do this column. He says, I'll probably take you down in a month. You know, but let's see. This was the online division was just coming on with this particular weekly newspaper. So I started writing these little 300 to 500 word articles, right? And he calls me in a month later, and I figure, well, that's it. It's over with. And he says, no, you're a rock star. And I said, what do you mean? He says, you're pulling more page views than all of our columnists combined.
Wow.
And it's been like that since. And I've been doing it for 3 years.
That's the interest. I mean, there's such an interest in this topic out there. And if people would just wake up, I mean, shoot, my goodness. You know,
well,
let me tell you,
go ahead.
Well, it's just that, I mean, if the people in companies and governments and positions of authority would just wake up and realize how much interest there is in this and, you know, maybe actually help out.
Well, let me tell you a little story about this. Again, since I come from a production background, I always was very good at reaching out to a news editor or somebody like that and pitching an idea. And if I could turn down, I went to the next city desk someplace and called them up, you know. And I could make 5 phone calls and maybe get 1 guy to bite. I could make 10 phone calls and get 3 people to bite, okay? So I was always good at doing that kind of thing, you know, whether I was promoting my community theater group or if I was promoting God knows what else, okay? I used to be part of a choir, you know, that all that kind of stuff. So doing public relations has always been a good thing for me. So what happened was, you know, this book, my book is the UFO Sightings Desk Reference, United States, 2001 to 2015. Two things.
Huge.
We decided to take a nice, clean 15-year slice, and we decided to make it distinctly 21st century data, because how many UFO books do you see out there on a day-to-day basis or at a convention or something? They're always regurgitating something from the 1940s or the 1950s or that great sighting in 1970-something, you know, and they're always regurgitating all this stuff. I said, why can't we just take a good look at what's been happening in the last 10 or 15 years? Because remember, in 2001, after 9/11, they said, report what you see. So that's what we did.
Mm.
I got a lot of other people did it too. So,
man.
Okay, so now let me tell you where this has gone. I reached out to over 100, just slightly over 100 press and media organizations across the United States, mostly focused on the top 10 states for this, based on this book, okay? And West Coast particularly. And I reached out to them and pitched the story to them. I pitched them twice. I pitched them when I had the information and the book was getting ready to come out. This past weekend, the actual book went hot on Amazon. I sent all this stuff, and only one media organization of 100 decided to do a story with us. Everybody else, it was deafening silence. Except, I'm sorry, there was a guy at the San Francisco Chronicle who said, oh, UFOs, that was settled years ago. And I could only think about what was he smoking. You know?
Yeah, that's
you
so
know?
Weird.
He was talking the Condon Report and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So here's where this went. You know, real quick, you're gonna love this. 24 hours ago, a story I did with the Seattle PI, it's called the Post Intelligencer, went hot, okay? And a copy of that article tweaked to California's numbers, went into what they called the SF Gate. It's a San Francisco Chronicle online edition. And that happened in the last 24 hours. And in the last 12 hours, the West Coast is on fire. I just before I called your show, I was being interviewed by KABC.
Wow!
If you Google the UFO sightings desk reference, you will find that it is at the top of Google's hits. And
wow.
As of about 2 hours ago, they stopped listing Amazon.com as the purveyor, and there was a paid ad by Barnes & Noble on Google. It's going crazy right now, okay?
That's awesome.
And they said, in fact, one article from a San Diego paper said that social media went crazy today when they found out that California was the number one state in the country, okay? People are hungry for these numbers. Now, let me give you one last number. In 2012, National Geographic did a poll, and they found that 36% of Americans were firm believers, 42% were sort of on the fence, 17% didn't believe in it, no ifs, ands, or buts, but 70% believe that the government's hiding what it knows.
Wow.
So, yeah, lots of people are interested. And I said this to a lot of editors as a leading line to my pitch, saying, look, 70% of your audience is interested in this topic. Do this. And again, they all ignored me. Now they can't call me fast enough to get a story because somebody took a chance on it and it ran. And the media is like that. If one person does it, everybody's got to do it.
I think it's very interesting that in your life you had time to read and study this material. It was almost like it was predetermined or pre-planned. Have you ever thought of it from that perspective?
I wondered about that. That recuperation period, that like 3 or 4 months recuperation period, was sort of like a retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
And I'll give you one more tidbit you probably don't know. I don't make a big deal of it. But I lived in a Buddhist monastery for 7 years.
Really?
And yeah, from 1977 to, I'm sorry, not, I said the wrong date, 1997 through to about 2004, end of 2004. I wore the buzz cut and I wore the nun's robes of a Tibetan Buddhist nun. I dressed like the, you'll love this. I was still working at a major aerospace firm at headquarters in the Washington, D.C. area, and I literally came to work every day dressed like the Dalai Lama.
No kidding.
Yeah. And it was a bit of an experience for everybody. I literally pushed their diversity policies to the bleeding edge. But it was an interesting experience for me. And so this whole topic matter of UFOs, when I talked it over with one of my lamas that I was going to start writing a column, he looked at me and he said, you know, he says, part of what we teach is being able to expand your reality and accept truths you normally wouldn't accept. And I'll give you an example of people's reality. I was working downtown here right up until about a month ago, and I would come down to, from where I was working in this office, I'd come down to the coffee shop downstairs. Okay, kind of like a Starbucks. And I was sitting there, and the barista was getting my thing together, and a couple of them knew I was working on the book, and they knew I was a columnist and everything, and they said, Cheryl, how many numbers we got for New York State? And I said, 5,141. And this lady behind me tapped me on the shoulder and said, did I hear you right? You said there was over 5,000 UFO sightings, and did you say the last 15 years? And I said, yes. And me and the barista watched the color drain from her face, and we had to help her to a chair. Because
really?
We just shattered her reality. And this has played out about 6 or 7 times over the past year.
You've seen people have that kind of reaction just in regards to sightings.
Yeah. I had a lady, the barista, again, was talking to me, and a lady tapped me on the shoulder and says, do you write that column for the newspaper? And I said, yeah. I said, well, how many sightings do we have in New York State? I said, well, how many do you think we have in a year? And she said, maybe 25 or 30. And I said, how about 400 to 500 a year? And she almost passed out. She says,
seriously?
How come we don't hear about it? And I said, yeah, that's the big question. How come we don't hear about it? You know?
Let me throw something in here because,
whatever
you
like.
The lady that, I don't know which one of these, but I think the first one you talked to, that all the color drained out of her face and she had to sit down. I've had, you know, people from different organizations on that just get all worked up that we need the government to tell us this and to come out. And, you know, I think it would be great if, you know, we had, you know, this kind of openness with the government. First of all, there's so much corruption in the government, I would be not very inclined to believe what they had to say. And the second thing is there's so much information out there, like you said. I mean, you spent months reading every day. So it's not that you need the government to tell you these things. I mean, because there's so much good information out there as it is. But on the other hand, there are people like the lady that almost passed out that aren't quite ready for this yet. And I mean, can you imagine the way it just blows the world away to hear things like this? I mean, and you're really covering the most non-controversial aspect of this, which is the sightings. Can you comment on that?
Just magnitude. That's it.
Yeah.
In fact, our book, on the front cover of our book, other than the main title, underneath a hand-drawn graphic of a saucer UFO with windows around the middle, okay, that's a very classic one. It was the kind that they associated with Betty and Barney Hill, that kind of thing. And we had a local artist hand-draw it, because a lot of people, when they report UFOs, they're drawn on crayons or felt-tip pens, things like that. They make a little sketch. And we wanted something reminiscent of that on our cover. Underneath it, it simply says, we laid this thing out like a scientific journal. My spouse used to publish scientific journals in Washington, D.C. for 30 years, major agencies, So she laid it out, and there's the title up at the top, the title, the art graphic, just a little bit of a cell on a white page, and then underneath it, frequency, distribution, and shapes. That's all we did. In fact, I had MUFON call me up. They were a couple of weeks ago. They were all upset. Oh my God, you revealed all kinds of confidential information. And I said, no, I didn't use that. I had only public information. What, when, and where, and what shape. That's all I was interested in. All we did was add these things up. In fact, one of the first things we did when we were crunching the data in the Excel spreadsheets, we dropped off the columns that had the descriptions of it. We dropped them. We kept the cities, dates, and the shapes. That's all we kept.
So interesting. Okay. Have you ever been up to Mount Adams?
I don't know where that is.
East City Ranch. I think it's. It's in Oregon. It's right by Washington State. Have you ever heard of that, Mount Adams, East City Ranch? James Gilliland.
Vaguely, but I'm not really familiar with it.
The reason I bring that up is because, I mean, I've been up there twice, and you can literally almost any night of the week sit in this field he has there, and look at Mount Adams, and hundreds of people come from all over the world, and they sit there and they watch. These things come right out of sight of Mount Adams or...
Oh, yeah, I mean, you don't have any light pollution. They're easy to see,
Unbelievable. It's amazing.
I'll give you one that's almost similar to that. I'm in Syracuse, New York. About an hour south of me, hour and 15 minutes south of me, is quite literally in the woods of Pennsylvania, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a medieval reenactor, okay? I do LARP. I don't know if you know what that is.
No, I don't.
Okay, it means I dress up a couple of different weekends in the nice warm months, and I run around with a large rubber sword dressed in medieval armor or something, and we chase monsters through the woods,
Okay.
I don't chase as much as I used to, but because I'm getting a little old for it. But let's see, this was back in the fall, September, and this is Montrose, Pennsylvania. It is away from any major metropolitan area, so there was no light pollution. You could see the Milky Way clear as a bell.
Mm-hmm.
So one night, I was asked to guard the tavern. It's just a barn that's been converted to look like a medieval tavern, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I was standing, I was out front playing guard, okay? And I laid my head back, and I was watching things in the sky. Now, I quickly ascertained the flight pattern for Scranton Airport, probably about 35, 40 miles down the road.
Mm-hmm.
What I couldn't explain was 15 other sightings that were at a very high altitude, and if they were, quote, as people tried to tell me, oh, it must have been a satellite, the satellite would have had to have been the size of a Mack truck, okay, to be as big as the thing I saw. And I counted 14 freaking UFOs, And of course, I didn't have any pen or paper or anything like that. And my mindset wasn't where I needed to be a columnist. I was a medieval person, and I was guarding the tavern from monsters. You know, so I didn't report those. You know, but to give you a flavor, though, a lot of people don't, because especially if they live in urban areas, and which is weird, is urban areas seem to have a lot of sighting count. And a lot of people, when they started seeing some of my numbers, some local investigators were borrowing some of my spreadsheets, and they were looking at the numbers. Well, they said, well, they all seem to be congregated on population centers. I said, well, that raises the chicken or the egg syndrome. Are there lots of sightings there because there are more people there to see the sightings, or are the there are more UFOs there because there's lots of people there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... So they started saying, well, what do we use your charts for? And I said, why don't you go and do something interesting and start. We added, so you know, we did something very interesting. We took New Fork data and we took MUFON data, cleaned it up. We had to do a lot of scrubbing. The data was very nasty, and it was not 3% of the people who made entries didn't put a city in it. Okay?
Hmm.
So, you know, I counted them, but I had to call them unspecified and had to assign them to a county called Unknown. So all 50 states have a county called Unknown. But I kept the site. It worked up to about 3,100 for the entire United States, but that was 2%, you know, for the whole United States. And it varied from state to state what the numbers were, our percentages were. But what we did was we had the date, we had the city, and we had to clean up spelling on the cities. Some of those blank spots where people didn't either, if they did put, sometimes they wrote something in other than the city, and they say, I'm afraid to tell you, or I've been asked, my mother has asked me not to tell you, or my husband has asked me not to tell you where we are. I found a lot of them like that. People were scared. They're afraid that they fill it out in the form that the government can see them through the form or something. I don't know. But what we did was, National UFO Reporting Center data did not have county data. And back in 2013, I had written Pete Davenport and asked him about that. And he said, well, yeah, put a map on the wall, put a pin in it. You know, and that's not going to be good for data crunching, obviously. So what I did was we got county data for every state, and we merged it in based on city. There wasn't a script for it. I wrote a couple of scripts. Had to dig out some of that old software skill. And we inserted county data in for every single state. The MUFON data, while it did have some county data, it was sloppy or non-existent because, again, it was dependent on the people who were reporting it to know what county they were in, and half of them didn't have a county submitted. So we just kind of nuked out that, and since I was actually I had a script going in there looking at the cities and putting a county with it, the appropriate county with it, that's what we did. So every single sighting of the 121,036 sightings that are in our book has a county associated with it.
That's
now
good.
People say, why do we want to know counties? Well, suddenly, I used to live in rural upstate New York, and where I lived, we had a trailer park with about 30 trailers. We had a general store that sold Haagen-Dazs on one side of the street, and across the street of the, quote, intersection was a volunteer fire department, and then the trailer park. And so some of these places that were a town were not much more than a general store, a fire department, and a road crossing or a cattle crossing. Now, that doesn't make much sense to you if you got a sighting for Weltonville out here, and then you got another one here for, you know, Bobbysburg or something like that, and you don't know what those are. But all of a sudden, you start seeing, you have county data, and you do your data scan on that way. Suddenly, you start seeing, why is there a cluster out there in the middle of nowhere?
That's where it always is, isn't it?
Yeah, but people don't see it because they don't know where to, unless you put pins on the map.
Right.
You don't know where these places are.
Exactly.
Another thing, go ahead, I'll shut up for a minute, ask your questions.
Okay. Well, I have a caller that I'm going to bring on the line here. Sometimes we get crank calls. If it's a crank call, I'll just mute him. So I just want to warn you ahead of time. I have no idea.
Okay, go ahead. I'm good with it.
Okay. 830. You're on the air, 830. Go ahead and ask your question.
Yeah, how are y'all? I was just listening in. I'm from Texas. I live out, in the southern part. San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some acreage, and we get a lot. Actually, the other night, it was very weird. There's three of us in the car. And I was driving when we were pulling in, and I was like, did you see that? Because I thought what it looked like was, when you start like a very big fire, like say you're burning like trees,
mm-hmm,
or brush, and it's very hot, and it's just, it was a bright orange, like, it was real foggy anyway. So I thought, some family members maybe had been burning cedar or something. And it was like a sphere of light. And
that's what we call a classic fireball.
They didn't see it. I was the only one.
Hmm.
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. Sometimes people, I've literally seen situations where people were literally, two or three people, maybe eight or ten people, were supposedly outside looking at something. Two of them were pointing out something rather substantial, and the rest of them couldn't see it. And it was right there in front of them. There's this effect, there's this psychological effect called non-expected syndrome, where if you don't expect to see it, then you don't.
Wow.
And your brain just kind of mutes it out. By the way, a guy in Texas, what county are you in there?
Kendall.
Kendall?
Yes.
I'm not spelling it right. How's it spelled?
It's,
K-I-N?
The town I'm in is, it's B.
No.
Like, it's
No. No. I need to know the county.
Okay, it's K-E... N D A L L.
Okay, Kendall. Okay. All right, Kendall, Texas. Kendall County, Texas. Okay, Kendall County, Texas, for the last 15 years, ranks in the United States number 1,279 as their rank, and they've had 14 sightings in the last 15 years, basically about one a year.
Huh.
You know, what you were talking about there about, people, some people seeing it and some people not, I've experienced that myself. I had an incredible sighting, it's probably been 5 years ago, on an expressway, and me and my wife pulled over. We saw this gigantic ball of light that was maybe 20 or 30 feet above the expressway. We were on the northbound side, they were on the southbound side, the other folks. And this ball of light materialized about 20 or 30 feet above the other side of the expressway, and it just sat there, and we pulled the car off the expressway and watched this thing. And then the light went away, and I saw this little boomerang-shaped craft come out of the light. It crossed the expressway, and then it flew counter to the traffic up over our head in the vehicle that we were in, and then it disappeared in the clouds. But you would think that there'd have been at least four or five cars that pulled over. But no, I wonder if they didn't see it as well.
It's possible. People constantly, I'll give you another example of it. How many times have you lost your keys and then finally settled down, sat down in a chair and said, God, where did I put them? And then you look on the coffee table and there they are right in front of you, and they've been there all the time.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Definitely.
Okay, this is the same sort of thing. If you don't expect it, depending upon a state of mind, you literally can't see certain things. It's a document. It's a documented psychological fact. They've done studies where they had a guy dressed up like a gorilla run out onto a basketball court, and nobody saw the gorilla.
That's crazy. That's absolutely crazy. I have heard that the Native American Indians, when they first started seeing the big ships come in off the Atlantic Ocean, that like only their shaman could actually see the ships, and a lot of the other Indians just couldn't even literally see them.
Yeah, it's very true. It's amazingly enough. I talked with my lamas about this when I was in the Buddhist monastery. We talked about the fact that people's reality not being elastic enough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Some people have no sense of humor. That's partly an unelastic reality type of thing, you know, that they can wrap their head around the humor or something. But this being able to accept that something else is out there. There have been other examples where, we'll use Billy Meir for an example. Semyazi, the lady he had a lot of conversations with, said to him that some people's mental state, if their ship was parked right there in front of them in the sky, they saw some cartoon representation. If they had no frame of reference in their head for what they were seeing, they saw that their brain did the best they could to paint it as something else. Okay.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
I had a little pile of dirt out here. The snow just melted off here in the last couple of days here. Okay. And there was a little pile of dirt off the side of my porch. And from my back porch door, I happened to glance over, and I thought there was a little brown bunny looking at me from just off the porch. And I sit there very quietly for 10 minutes waiting for this, quote, brown bunny to move. And I finally walked out across the porch, and it was the way the dirt was shaped, and there happened to be a little stone there, which happened to make me think it was an eye, but that's what I thought was the bunny. But it was shaped in such a way that my brain interpreted that to be a little brown bunny.
Yeah. So we see with our brains, really.
Yes, yes.
And that's an interesting situation. Caller, did you have any more questions? I can put you on mute if you don't.
I don't. I was just listening.
Okay, great. I'll put you on mute. You can keep listening. That's
very
good. You're welcome. Thank you for calling. I wanted to ask you, Cheryl, do you feel that you had kind of a spiritual awakening when you started reading all this material?
Let me say it this way. I kind of grew up around my Portuguese grandmother, so I sort of grew up in the shamanic arts, if you know what I mean. So sort of like native medicine man type of thing. She came from a little island that's part of Portugal, and she was a little lady they used to go to find out what kind of baby they were going to have, that kind of thing. So she was just like a little shaman lady. And I kind of, after I left the Catholic Church in my teens, I kind of grew up into her tradition, okay? So when I had that abdominal surgery back in about 1990, I was in a situation where the gentleman who let me use his house, I knew him from the shamanic community, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I was already knowing that going into his house, I knew that I would be exposed to a lot of spiritual stuff because the man was a significantly well-trained adept, as they say. So I was rather surprised when I saw the amount of UFO material that he had and other types of paranormal material, you know. It itself wasn't a spiritual awakening. For me, though, when I started writing my column, I saw this as a pastoral practice, helping people hear the stories of other people's sightings, maybe help them grow the elasticity of their own reality enough that maybe they can appreciate when they see something someday. Or maybe you wouldn't believe how many people wrote my column over the last 3 years and say, hey, would you come to a backyard barbecue at our house, because we all read your column. We want you to meet our Uncle Ralph, you know.
Really?
And I'll come over there, have a glass. I would come over there and have a glass of lemonade with them and a burger, and they'll sit me down with their Uncle Ralph or their Aunt Susie or somebody, and they'll have that person tell me their UFO story.
Wow.
The ones that are genuine, the ones that are genuine, and most of them are, if you've ever talked to a vet, a military vet who was a combat vet, and they start telling you about one of their war experiences, you can see it in their eyes. They're there again, kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you can see it with these people when they're recalling what they saw. You can tell they are there again. Mm-hmm. I watched this one guy break out into a sweat when he was telling me about it. And I was making a sketch of it, and he says, yeah, that's what it was, you know, and that kind of thing. What I found out, and I wrote an article about this a couple of years ago, people are handing down these stories of UFO sightings from within their families. Some of these things have been confessed on deathbeds, that type of thing. They're handing down their UFO stories like family heirlooms. Isn't
wow.
that amazing?
That's really cool.
I had a lady come to me last year and give me one from her family from 1880. It was like her great-great-aunt. When her great-great-aunt was going to school in the early 1880s in this remote part of New York State, the kids were going to the little schoolhouse 7 miles away when I was a kid, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to go cross a swollen spring stream over a bridge, and there were these little men, bald men with big eyes in blue jumpsuits that waved to them and told them to come down and see them down by the creek, and the kids were terrified and ran off.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's really interesting. See, that's the kind of stuff that interests me a little more. And it seems that these sightings sometimes can go generational. Like if the father had sightings, the son will, etc. Have you noticed that?
I've heard those stories. I've heard those stories mostly with experiencers.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to follow family genetic lines.
Yeah.
My first time with experiencers was I was at the International UFO Congress, IUFOC, down in Arizona a couple
yeah.
years ago. And in 2014 I went there, and they wouldn't let press come in to these morning meetings that they had. It's kind of like an AA meeting, you know, for
mm-hmm.
people who are experiencers. So the second year I went there, I said I went to the psychiatrist or psychologist who was running them, and I said, look, I'll leave my press credentials upstairs. Can I just come in and get a feel for this? I promise not to write about anybody seeing or, you know, expose anybody. I just want to understand it. And they were kind mm-hmm. enough to let me do this. And I was expecting to walk into something like an AA meeting where everybody was crying in their beer or crying in their soup or something, you know. And
right.
I thought maybe there'd be 25 or 30 people. There was 150 people in there, and it was like a very joyous event. They were
wow.
all very excited about this fantastic experience they had. And at one point, it felt like I was at some, excuse the expression, a black Baptist church on a Sunday morning, and everybody's singing hallelujah. I mean, it had that kind of energy to it.
Wow, that's
cool. It was
cool.
Amazing.
I
yeah.
think that's good. That's really neat. I think a lot of the negative side is too promoted. I think most people's experiences are very positive.
You know, I got about 25 minutes before I talked to you, I was being interviewed by KABC in Los Angeles, probably after
mm-hmm.
the talk show out there. And
mm-hmm.
they brought that topic up towards the end of the interview. They asked me about people getting probed and everything. And I said, you know, I said, that's the hype that's on these stranger than kind of programs. They talk about somebody getting probed or whatever, you know. But you know something? It's from what I've been able to ascertain, talking to people in these experiencer groups, that's a very tiny, tiny percentage. Most of the people I have talked to had a very positive experience, maybe a little terrifying the first time around, but it was
right.
Well, hell, even Whitley Strieber tells you it was terrifying the first time around until he got used to these guys. you know?
Right. And I wonder if the government plays a role in kind of pushing this whole fear thing.
I don't know. I don't think the government's that organized.
It's too disorganized. It's some other group, whoever they are, maybe.
Well, you know, Steve Bassett from Paradigm Research.
Oh, yeah,
He uses the term of the unacknowledged special operations
access.
Units, you know?
Yeah, right.
And there are probably some dark units that this is their mission. From what he's told me, there's a couple of them have sort of privately come out to him and said, yeah, we'd like to see this stuff out too, you know. But because of the secrecy oaths they're under, they can't come out and tell. So it's sort of a chicken or egg situation. Somebody high enough in the government's got to get them to come out, but then, you know, it's complicated. But I think disclosure is coming. I guess the biggest thing is if you talk to the disclosure people, okay, and there's a bunch of different disclosure groups out there right now. If you talk to them, they say, well, you know, America's ready. This is not like 70 or 80 years ago. And I wrote a paper like this. I was finishing up a bachelor's degree a few years ago, and I wrote a paper. And I said, in one part of the paper, I said, look, 70 years ago, the movies depicted aliens as bug-eyed, slimy monsters. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now they are our most revered fictional characters. Mr. Spock, Mr. Skywalker, you know, Han Solo. You don't get what I'm getting at here. And little gray aliens adorn our greeting cards.
Right.
Now, are people ready for this? Well, yeah, I think a lot of people are ready for it. And a lot of people might just say, oh, wow, they are real. You know, in fact, we were hoping President Obama would come out with this thing before he left office, you know. And I wrote several articles. This is what it could look like. And I painted a picture in a city. I'm a playwright. I painted a picture of what that press conference would look like. Oh, I got more hate mail you can shake a stick at. But
really? Why would,
yeah,
why did you get hate mail?
Well,
why,
there's all these people who hate Obama. Okay.
Oh,
and,
oh, yeah.
You know, but it could be any president. You know,
sure,
but
I
used him. And so the bottom line on this whole thing is I think most people are ready. But there is that contingent of people who do not believe in this stuff, and they're going to crap a codfish when the truth comes out.
That's the funniest thing I've heard.
Sorry to be a little blue there, but you know.
That was great. I love it. But you're right. You know, you're right. They are. There's a few that will. I'm real surprised that the lady that.
Well, it goes
the
along
color...
with what I was telling you earlier in the talk. How
yeah.
These two or three women and men who lost color in their face when they heard how many numbers we had. I watched some people who, and I'm going to call them millennials, and we had in that same coffee shop, we had a three-ring binder with a document protectors in there and a collection of my weekly columns were sticking there. We'd print them out and stick them in these little document protectors. So people had something to read over there at the coffee table, right? And I saw a bunch of them over there one day. They had their cell phones out. It looked like a World War II spy thing. They had their cell phones out, and they were taking pictures of the pages that were inside the book because I had charts and graphs and things like this for New York State. And I heard one guy over there, he's probably in his mid-20s, saying, these numbers can't be legit. He said, you know, they can't be legit. We'd hear something about something like this if they were legit, you know? Again, why do we have to have the government tell us this stuff? Because there's a lot of people who have to have some authority figure say, yes, it is.
Isn't that funny, too? And I think that's a problem. People need to learn to have independent thinking. And if you do have independent thinking, then it's, you know, it's fine if it happens, and it's not a big deal if we have to wait longer. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
you have your truth now, and you've done the research, right? I mean, you know now, right?
Yeah.
I
knew a few years ago, but that's okay.
Oh, obviously, yeah. But
well, let me give you a flavor for that.
Sure.
Do you know what remote viewing is?
Oh, of course, yes.
Okay, yeah, I'm talking military style coordinate remote viewing. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There was a point where I taught I was running a small Buddhist center, and I mm-hmm. taught classes in remote viewing. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it went very well. And you wouldn't believe the wide eyes you'd get, if, especially if the target queue, I don't know what's in the target queue. I got 100 letters there. I got 100 envelopes there with target queues. I don't know what's in there. But the group, you talk them through their protocols, you get all done with the whole thing. And part of this was me as a monk trying to teach them how to meditate themselves down and touch something outside, experience a knowledge outside of their, to know something without experiencing it.
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay, that's what remote viewing is. If I let you touch a grape, you've experienced it. Now you know it. Now, if you do it with remote viewing, you know it without experiencing it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they would come back, and this one particular class came back at me, and they said, whoever those people were, they didn't want us to come back, and they actually asked us to leave. And we opened up the target queue, and what was it? We sent them to one of the alien bases on the backside of the moon.
Whoa.
Okay.
Now,
these are the same guys Ingo Swann touched back in 1985 for some intelligence unit, and they had like a triple blind envelope for him, and he went and did a remote viewing for him. He says, I don't know where you sent me, but they did not like that I was there, and they told him, and he was shocked, you know, because this was a reality that there's other folks out there. They don't want us there. So,
do you have the ability to remote view whenever you want to?
Yeah. I've been at it long enough, yeah. And, of course, because I lived in a monastery, I know how to meditate down. I can put myself down. My dentist loves this. I can put myself down to the level of a general anesthetic. You know,
That's
loves
that. That is really cool. So is part of it learning to put your conscious mind out of the picture, so to speak?
Okay, there's two parts to it. You got your left brain, right brain, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Your left brain has a part of the thing they teach remote viewing to keep you keep your left brain busy, your concepts
mm-hmm.
out of your brain. They have you filling in the page numbers and drawing the lines and keeping very close track of the procedure, the rigid procedure part of the remote viewing,
mm-hmm.
okay? That allows, and as a writer, I like that too. I do the same technique when I'm writing. I'm writing down page numbers, the date that I actually write the page. When I turn the page and I start to write, handwrite on a new fresh page, I write pen to paper. I'm old school. And I'll write down the date and I'll write the page number down and I'll proceed with my story. Okay? That's to keep the left brain busy while the right brain is out creating universes.
Yeah.
Okay, and remote viewing works very much like that. You've got to numb down the conscious chatter of your conceptual mind and let the organic part of your mind just touch the greater consciousness. That's the trick to the whole thing. And I know you're an engineer. I came from an engineering background. That was the hardest thing for me to do because I had to learn to let go and not analyze how is this working. I just had to let it go and be part of it.
Well, it's almost like meditating then, isn't it?
Yeah, meditating will get you down. The biggest trick we teach people in Buddhist teachings is we teach them to quiet, and it's one of the things we have to teach remote viewers. We have to teach them to quiet what we call the monkey chatter in their head.
Yeah.
And the way we start that is we make sure everybody turns off their cell phones and locks them up in their car. And then we bring them in. And then we teach them how to meditate. And it's not so much organic, hard, you know, classic, you know, thousands-year-old meditation. These days we use these oral sync things where you're pumping a white noise in both ears, and it's maybe 8 hertz difference on one side than it is the other, and it puts about an 8 hertz beat between the two hemispheres of the brain. You can put somebody into a Zen alpha in about 20 minutes with one of those.
Gosh, meditation is so important, and I neglect it, and I don't know why I do, but I do. It's just so critical. Because it's the right brain that really is going out there and searching for the truth and finding it, right?
Yes. Yes, it's the right brain that's touching the great consciousness. And the moment you start trying, the left brain starts trying to conceptualize it, then it gets colored. So
now,
I don't know how soon we got to kill the show here. I don't want to run you over time.
I put a little extra time on there for us, so go ahead and finish your thought for sure.
Okay, here's the thought here. What's going to come out probably in the very near future, and this is, you know, in the UFO community, they tend to be purists. You know, it's either got to be some kind of great, fantastic Star Trek type of technology out there, or and if people start talking about spirituality with it, oh, that's baloney. You know, they don't, the technology side of people don't want to hear about that. Oh, they've got some kind of hard, cold, fast, you know, technology here. We want to hear about the technology. We don't want to hear about the woo-woo stuff, okay? And what people are going to find out, and probably when disclosure comes, they're going to find out that this thing, consciousness, is a big deal with this, and that the ability to, you hear about these people who are like UFO whisperers. They can sit there in the middle of a field and with a couple of people standing around them, and they can literally call one of these things. Well, yeah, they can, and there's a bunch of couple of people that can do this really well. And I saw a guy down in Arizona a couple of years ago do this, and it was amazing. So the thing is, there's a consciousness factor here. And hell, even Billy Meir said this stuff, you know, that, you know, Shemyazi would talk to him and say, you know, that people got too much clutter going on in their head, and trying to communicate with Earth people were very difficult. And why was she able to talk to him so easily? He used to live in an ashram.
Oh yeah, the Ashoka Ashram in India.
Okay,
yeah.
So he's got he had a settled mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I always admired by her. And I'll tell you something. You know what? Nook really convinced me this stuff really worked. This stuff really was real. And you know, I hear so many people. I wrote an article about Billy about a year ago, and I had so much hate mail. Everybody telling me he's a fraud. He's this and that. You know? Well, I'll tell you something. I saw his early film footage and some of his early video footage back in the early 90s. The stuff this shaman friend of mine had in his collection. All that Colonel, there was a guy who was supporting Billy on this stuff.
Oh,
and,
of course. Now you made me forget. I can't believe it.
You know
Wendell
who I'm talking
Stevens.
About, though.
Wendell Stevens.
Wendell Stevens, right. Okay.
Yeah,
well, I was looking at this video. Early on in my career, remember I said I used to make industrial movies?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm a good video editor. And a good video editor tends to be able to see down at the frame rate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I was watching the film footage just before one of these beam shits decided to take a jog off to another position in the sky. And
mm-hmm.
every time they did it, there was two or three frames that had kind of a... I don't want to call it a flash. It was kind of like a disturbance in the light.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a flash. It appears like a flash to some people if they even perceived it. I saw it and said, wait a minute, what the hell is that? It was two or three frames that kind of looked like, remember when TVs used to be on like on antennas, if there was a thunderstorm in the distance, sometimes the screen would kind of brighten up a little bit. But it was
mm-hmm.
always just the static was brightening the screen. You had more static than you did a minute ago kind of thing. Well, that's what this looked like. And I started looking at them, all these films that my friend had and all these videos that my friend had, and it was consistent signature. And I said, wait a minute, these guys are doing some kind of either magnetic pulse or something that is changing the local interference pattern, the time-space stuff here, okay? This is classic, you know, light through the slit kind of experiment, okay?
Right.
And I'm going, whoa, this is nuts. And then I kind of kept it to myself. And then a couple of years later, there's that classic piece of video from one of the space shuttles when the astronauts were sleeping and the camera was looking out the backside, and there was this thing dancing around out there behind the shuttle, and suddenly it took off because it looked like there was a beam coming up from the planet, like somebody was shooting a particle beam at it or something. It was a classic
wow.
piece of video. And
right.
when I saw that piece of video, I saw that flash. And I looked at my spouse and said, that's genuine footage. And she said, how? And I had it videotaped, and I backed it down, slowed it down frame by frame, and showed her. and it's a consistent thing. And I've tried to explain this to people, that there's this consistent electromagnetic effect there, and it shows up in every one of his videos and films. Slightly different with film because the frame rate's different, but it's there consistently.
Well, thanks for bringing that up, Cheryl. I really appreciate that, and I really appreciated chatting with you this evening. It's been a lot of fun, and I hope when your schedule frees up, we can have you back on, but I'm sure you're going to be busy. Sounds like your book is really getting a lot of popularity.
Have me on any time.
Okay,
great.
Have
me on any time. And, oh, by the way, Ohio ranks number 10 in the top 10.
Wow.
So, you
awesome.
Know. And get my book, the UFO Sightings Desk Reference, United States 2001 to 2015, by Cheryl Costa and Linda Miller Costa.
Do you have a website yet?
No, I don't. Amazon's doing a rather nice job of that. In fact, with all the traffic that's been happening on the West Coast in the last 24 hours, if you Google the UFO Sightings Desk Reference, it'll probably come up number one in your Google, and there's a link to Amazon. Go to Amazon, and it's got all the information about the book. I'm not even bothering to put a web page up. I've got a page up in Facebook, but that's it. I'm just vectoring everybody to Amazon, letting them deal with it.
Sounds good, Cheryl. Have a great evening. We'll
you
see
too.
You.
Have us back, please.
Bye-bye. Will do. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.